challenges facing our communities, but also these kind of long and intertwined histories of solidarity, of coalitional politics, right? It is critically important for all of us to be at the table speaking about this, and for allies, you know, to come together and support communities that may not have the resources, that may not have the platform.
Really not just struggle for the low-hanging fruit, not just struggle for the things that are actionable items that, that we can do kind of in the immediate, because so often those turn into transactional reforms, when what we really need is long-haul social movement building. There's something that happens when we dream big and when we have a radical imagination. We begin to see the world that we actually want. People are talking about a lot, right, which is self-care. And I'd like to think about it as collective care. And this is a lesson that I've really learned from Yuri Kochiyama. And she's, of course, best known for having worked with Malcolm X. She always cared about the political prisoners. She would tell people it's their birthdays, you need to send them a card. She always asked people how they were. And I think it's really important that we take time to take care of ourselves, whatever that means. And I think to be reflective and to slow down.
And they said, oh, no one from our community is speaking this way. Oh, we're allowed to speak that way? I don't think they knew they were allowed to speak that way. So she was really inspired by what he had to say. And, you know, she was from California and she didn't return to California after World War II. Because I think she was a little bitter about being on the West Coast. I think most people were. And so she went to the East Coast. And over there, you were getting discussions that weren't happening on the West Coast.
Harlem was the place to go. I would pick up, you know, leaflets on the street. And gee, it would be so interesting that I wanted to know more, and I'd pick up every time I see a leaflet, and it'll say when the next event or what. All my kids started in real young, and they used kids for a lot of things, where kids were getting hit by cars. They asked all the mothers to bring their toddlers and or babies and put them in the middle of the street and don't let any cars pass. And we're going to stay there until the government will give traffic lights throughout Harlem.
I don't advocate any kind of hate. No, I think that the guilt complex of the American white man is so profound until when you begin to analyze the real condition of the black man in America, instead of the American white man eliminating the causes that create that condition, he tries to cover it up by accusing his accusers of teaching hate. But actually, they're just exposing him for being responsible for what exists. I don't in any way encourage black people to go out and initiate acts of aggression indiscriminately against whites. But I do believe that the black man in the United States and any human being anywhere is well within his right to do whatever is necessary by any means necessary to protect his life and property, especially in a country where the federal government itself has proven that it is either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of those human beings.
Malcolm X seemed so radical, and if you remember way back then, all the media just crucified him. They tried to smash him, make him seem like such a hate monger, when all he was doing, he was just being very pro-black and fighting for his own people.
Cotton pickings don't move me. No. But when it comes to teaching the black people something about great black men who stood their ground, who were scientists, who were civilizers, who were fathers of culture and civilization, the white man has shrewdly written that role out of the textbook. And today, the effect that it has on you and me, we don't think we can stand on our own two feet.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, A Revolutionary Friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
You know, you had communities that were far more integrated and were much older, you know, in New York City having to live right next to each other. And so those conversations were older and were happening. I think she was really inspired by that and hearing people speaking out and saying, hey, we should speak out against injustices, because definitely within the Japanese American community, historically, you don't speak out against the government. You know, a lot of Japanese Americans thought that she wasn't patriotic, and they thought that she was being very anti-Japanese American. So, you know, it was more than just revolutionary for her as an American to speak out against him. It was like revolutionary within the community too. And she's still controversial within the community.
In the African American community, Malcolm X is still controversial as well, because he introduced the mass of African Americans to the religious concept of Islam. You know, he was a Muslim, and he made white people uncomfortable talking about standing up for your human rights and the whole repudiating King's statement on nonviolence, saying, you hit me, well, you know, you're going to have a problem there, bro. And because that made white people uncomfortable, it made black people uncomfortable too. So to this day, Malcolm X is still fairly controversial in the black community.
You know, the American press did not have a very good, I mean, they would not show any kind of a good image of Malcolm. But the Japanese knew that black people admired him and wondered also, however, why America would be afraid of one lone black man.
They didn't need civil rights legislation to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take a civil war to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take Supreme Court decisions to solve any other minority problem or legislation. It takes none of that other kind of that action to solve the minority problems of these other people. The only real minority in America is the Afro-American. Now, when white people, who are oppressed and poor, supposedly, but the poorest white person can go where the richest black person can't go. It isn't only poverty in money. That we're talking about, poverty in spirit, poverty in freedom, poverty in equality, poverty in human dignity. This is the kind of poverty we're suffering from. So that the richest Negro in this country is still poor. When it comes to freedom, he's broke. When it comes to human dignity, he's broke.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
I got that third world militant, still think it's relevant. Even if them kids cop the shirts and start wearing them. Humbled in the presence of the veterans, and not the ones who picked up their guns, but picked up their brethren and sisterin. History in the making, I was witnessing, listening. Seen this old Japanese lady with a sticker on her rocket said, free Mumia. And this was before the Trustafarians were saying it. Taking it for granted that we talk about the 60s and never get to talk to anybody who done lived and still exists. Better yet, she still resists speaking to a myriad of young, dumb, and ignorant kids. I was one of them, stuck around lingering. Said that it's a privilege to meet you in person, and she took my hand, said it's good to meet you too. And when I'm out of school, asked me what I'm gonna do. I had to think about it, but truth is I knew that it was something for the youth. Truly, I'd probably be a teacher if the music didn't make enough to make me wanna gamble on its sustenance. And that's why I'm writing this to tell y'all, from a scholar, when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my Kasamas. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor. Cause when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Comma, serve the people proper. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
And I had stated in a newspaper article about an effort to take my life back in January, and at that time the Muslims denied it.
Why are they threatening your life?
Well, primarily because they're afraid that I will tell the real reason that I'm out of the black Muslim movement, which I never told. I kept to myself. But the real reason is that Elijah Muhammad, the head of the movement, is the father of 8 children by 6 different teenage girls. 6 different teenage girls who were his private personal secretary. The one who first made me aware of this was Wallace Muhammad, Mr. Muhammad's son. And it was their fear that if I remained in the black Muslim movement and this came into the knowledge of his followers, that they would leave him and follow me. a plan immediately was set in motion to take me down, put me out, and the statement that I made about Kennedy was used as a pretext to take me down.
Did you get out of the... What do you take to protect yourself from this threat?
I take no steps. I have a rifle. If anybody comes to my house without a good reason, I intend to try and use it, and that's all.
Everyone knew, though, that Malcolm's life was in danger.
What brought me to her is a photograph in Life magazine. She is cradling the head of Malcolm X right after he's assassinated. She witnessed his assassination.
And she was attending his talks, you know, regularly there in Harlem, and she was sitting right near the front. She had her son with her, and she witnessed, and she ran up to be with her friend.
I seen a picture up in Life magazine. You were sitting in the front seat from Malcolm's last speech. Saw the first man with the shotgun. Two more came to get the job done. Now who would have thought that it'd be you holding him? I wonder what you felt when his eyes were going dim. And if he never died, would he know that he or would he been the leader that we always seem to miss? Now there's no turning back, whatever happens and I miss. You remind me that it's more than just a martyr and a myth. You could have said it quits many times ever since. And you find there will always be a reason for the fist. The last one to hold him could have been somebody else. You still be remembered for the people that you helped. They said it keep trying, but never losing hope. Revolutionaries die, but the revolution don't. And it won't, and I put that on my mama. Cause when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Koshiyama.
Who did one of these, what do you call it? You know, when you try to get attention?
Diversion.
What?
A diversion?
Yes, good thing. Two people did a diversion. One guy got up and said, "Get your hands out of my pocket." And they started fighting, the two. And when that fighting was going on, everybody was looking at them. They were just almost across from where we were sitting. But while we're all watching these two, the three people up front got up with shotguns and they hit Malcolm quite a few times. And I mean, you could imagine, here is Malcolm, one of the most beloved people by the people that were there for him in Harlem, and seeing him get shot and die. And then, of course, what happened was the cops were smart. They did, usually they're everywhere, but they didn't come into that hall that day. They wanted something to happen, and it did. Malcolm was killed. And it was such a big news that I know when I left the Audubon Hall, and I had to go to work at a restaurant, I didn't know whether I should go or not. But even the subways, they had a message through the subway system that Malcolm X was shot. I just want to read something about that someone wrote, which I thought was beautiful, about Malcolm. Malcolm was not just a black man. He was the black experience. He went through everything that the poorest blacks had gone through. He was baptized into blackness and repudiated his slave name and took on the X, the unknown, the potential of what could be, the reality of what he became. So I'm glad you asked the one question on Malcolm. Thank you.
So Malcolm and Yuri, they were born on the same day, May 19th. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. It's like their fates were kind of intertwined from the beginning.
May 19th. I'm so glad that they had the same birthday. I believe they have much more intelligent conversations than, what sign are you?
right?
I would love to hear that conversation anyways, because you know they would somehow make it really interesting.
They would. They would make it extremely interesting. They had a very unique friendship.
When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
You know, you spoke earlier about how controversial Yuri was and is in the Japanese-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in the African-American community, Malcolm X is still controversial as well because he introduced the mass of African-Americans to the religious concept of Islam. You know, he was a Muslim. And he made white people uncomfortable talking about standing up for your human rights and the whole repudiating King's statement on nonviolence, saying, you hit me, well, you know, you're going to have a problem there, bro. And because that made white people uncomfortable, it made black people uncomfortable, too. So to this day, Malcolm X is still fairly controversial in the black community. But Yuri, what brought me to her is that photograph in Life magazine. She is cradling the head of Malcolm X right after he's assassinated. She witnessed his assassination.
And she was attending his talks, you know, regularly there in Harlem, and she was sitting right near the front. She had her son with her, and she witnessed, and she ran up to be with her friend and cradled his head. And, you know, and you hear these interviews with her where she then goes on to talk about how the first thing she did after she cradled his head was to cradle his baby.
I know. Can you imagine as a child seeing your father assassinated?
Yeah, you can't even imagine.
After she witnessed the assassination, she definitely became an active presence in the civil rights movement. She went to the South.
She went to the South.
All right, well, one thing I like about Yuri, among the things I like about Yuri is when you have one culture admire and adore someone from another culture, sometimes they take on the dress or the slang or the, you know, the way the person talks. But Yuri didn't do any of that. She was always herself.
That's something I really admire about her and why I've always looked up to her as an activist within my community, because she exemplifies what I think activism should look like. You know, she was always one to want to connect communities in order to address oppression, but she was also about staying in your lane as a way to say, this is how we address oppression. You can't go and think that everybody's struggle is equal. You need to acknowledge that the struggle, you know, between this group and that group, that the power imbalance is there often because the government sets it up to be that way. It's in a systemic thing. And so you have to address it, and that you have to always be able to stay in your lane in order to be the most powerful voice that you can be. And so, you know, it's like within the Asian American movement, as you were talking about, there were many people who were appropriative of the civil rights movement and of the black struggle at the time. And she was just someone who always said, I want to amplify your voice. I want to help you with your struggle, and I will understand your struggle through my own. But then also have the compassion that comes from my struggle, but realize that it's not the same, and that I'm allowed to see that your struggle is more, and that I can help you. We can speak with unified voices while still seeing the difference in our experience.
Asian Americans must be more vocal, visible, and take stands on crucial issues. Hopefully, Asians will side with the most dispossessed, oppressed, and marginalized, remembering our own history. We Asians need to reshape our image from the rather quiet, ambiguous, accommodating, uncomplaining, palatable people to a more resolute, sensitive advocate for human worth, human rights, and human dignity.
Yeah, but okay, there's a cultural inference. I agree with what you're saying. There's a cultural, and for African Americans, there's a cultural inference to show you how different Yuri and Malcolm was in the African-American community viewed by the majority culture. There's an inference that African-Americans, people of color,
are inferior. Whereas in your community, you're Japanese American, you're the model minority.
Oh, yeah. We're number one. You're, or at least that's what...
You're
what,
one plus one, yeah. Okay? You're what people aspire to
yep,
be.
Yep.
And that creates some problems for your own community, right?
Oh, for sure. You know, there's a really great Japanese-American activist here in Portland named Scott... What is Scott's last name? Scott Nakamoto. Former KBOO volunteer. And... he always likes to talk about how Asian Americans are the fulcrum around of which oppression happens in this country for people of color, where Asian Americans are set up, right, as this model American or model minorities, especially Japanese Americans. We are the model minorities in that, you know, constantly our quote-unquote success is there to oppress other people of color, right? Because people always say, hey, if Japanese people can make it, then everyone else can make it. But they don't want to talk about the fact that Japanese people are literally allowed to succeed.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
This is Nia Gray, your faith reporter, with From the Grassroots. April 1964, that's when Malcolm X split with the Nation of Islam, shortly after he traveled on a pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca, where he was exposed to mainstream Islam. And I quote, "But we were all participating in the same ritual, displaying a spirit of unity and brotherhood that my experiences in America had led me to believe never could exist between white and non-whites. But on this pilgrimage, what I have seen and experienced has forced me to rearrange much of my thought patterns previously held and to toss aside some of my previous conclusions." Malcolm X later said that seeing Muslims of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans, interacting as equals led him to see Islam as a means by which racial problems could be overcome, quite different than the black separatists' philosophy of the Nation of Islam and their teachings that white people are devils. Malcolm didn't just have an epiphany of how true faith is colorblind with a message of acceptance. He also spoke truth to power when he heard rumors of Elijah Muhammad's extramarital affairs and subsequent illegitimate children fathered by him. Malcolm understandably became disillusioned when the rumors were found to be true. And instead of repenting for his wrongdoings, Muhammad attempted to justify his behavior using scripture. All people of faith should look to Malcolm X, including Christians, as an example of speaking truth to power and leadership of the church when they break from the truth, to hold them accountable to the scripture and the example that Jesus has left for us. No, the Bible doesn't say don't lock up immigrant children, but the Bible doesn't have to get that specific when the overarching theme is love. When Jesus was asked, "What is the most important commandment?" he responded, "Love your God with your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself." Loving your neighbor as yourself is the antithesis of racism, bigotry, and discrimination. The way you treat other people is a direct reflection of the maturity of your relationship with God. Like John wrote in the Bible, if you say you're a Christian and you hate your brother, the truth isn't in you. Martin Luther King once said, "He who passively accepts evil, as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetrate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it." And Malcolm X wasn't going to be complicit or turn a blind eye to his own folly. He wasn't afraid or too rigid in his beliefs to discard false understandings in light of reality and to remain dedicated to the truth. We should be just as bold and speak up when we see the hypocrisy in our modern churches, judging homosexuals while the male church members are addicted to pornography and pastors are molesting children. When the church aligns itself with ungodly political leaders while quietly appointing conservative judges. what do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? I suggest we don't leave churches, but we stay to change them from the inside out. Less than a year after his trip to Mecca, Malcolm X was assassinated. Malcolm X's life exemplifies a dedication to truth and justice, as well as a commitment to faith. This has been Nia Gray with your Faith Report.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
On February 21st, 1965, he was assassinated while giving a speech at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. Now, 56 years later, a letter given to Malcolm X's daughters could hold proof the NYPD and the FBI conspired to have him killed.
I am relieved that I am able to share this truth with the world today.
Reginald Wood reads the words of his cousin, former undercover cop Raymond Wood, who died in November. He wrote that letter in 2011 to be released upon his death.
It was my assignment to draw the two men into a felonious federal crime so that they could be arrested by the FBI.
Those men were members of Malcolm X's security detail and were arrested days before his assassination.
There was no security to prevent the gunmen from coming into the building.
Three members of the Nation of Islam were convicted of the murder.
Malcolm's death never sat right with me.
On the heels of the 2020 Netflix documentary, Who Killed Malcolm X?, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office began a preliminary review last February. After the letter's release, it says their review remains active and ongoing. As for the NYPD and the FBI, they say they have turned over all their relevant records to the DA and will cooperate.
Here, at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. For Harlem is where he worked and where he struggled and fought. His home of homes, where his heart was and where his people are. And it is therefore most fitting that we meet once again in Harlem to share these last moments with him. For Harlem has ever been gracious to those who have loved her, have fought for her, and have defended her honor even to the death. It is not in the memory of man that this beleaguered, unfortunate, but nonetheless proud community has found a braver, more gallant young champion than this Afro-American who lies before us, unconquered still. Many will ask what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain, and we will smile. And we will answer and say unto them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did he ever touch you? Did you have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. That was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is, a prince, our black shining prince who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so.
To be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
The last one to hold them could have been somebody else. You still be remembered for the people that you helped. They said to keep trying, but never losing hope. Revolutionaries die, but the revolution don't, and it won't. And I put that on my mama, cause when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my Kasamas. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Comma, serve the people proper. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
Yuri Kochiyama died June 1st, 2014. Malcolm X was assassinated February 21st, 1965. They were both born May 19th. Happy birthday, Malcolm. Happy birthday, Yuri. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News Northwest.
KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
It seems like recently the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first